This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Friday. That means it's time for our Week in Review. $2 million in legal fees later, Boston is dropping its legal fight against Wynn Resorts. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh reached an agreement with casino mogul Steve Wynn, and Walsh says the city is ready to move on.
There's other big issues in the city we have to deal with, and this has been lingering now for my entire time as mayor for 2 years, and now we can put it behind us and move forward.
The fight over the proposed Wynn Casino in Everett has been public, sometimes nasty. Also this week, Governor Baker filed his budget, and we're going to talk about allegations of racism at Boston Latin School. Plus, we remember the longtime former mayor of Providence. Joining us in the studio to talk about all this is Arlene Isaacson. She's co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Welcome, Arlene.
Thank you.
Also with us, Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe and a writer for WBUR's Cognoscenti page. Hello.
Happy to be here.
So let's start with this deal with the city of Boston and Wynn Resorts. Boston spent about $2 million for this legal fight with Wynn over its planned casino. And now Wynn says it will give Boston $6 million more than first suggested. So, Renee Loth, did Walsh win here?
Well, you know, I think the mayor deserves credit for getting himself out of the corner that he had painted himself into. And certainly an agreement is preferable to endless litigation. But I don't really think it's a very good deal for Boston. You know, over 6 years, this comes out to about $400,000 a year, which is like what the, you know, dry cleaning bill for Wynn or something. You know, and in the agreement, you know, the city gave up an important piece of leverage that they had over the casino. They had the right initially to fine Wynn up to $20 million if the traffic problems in Charlestown didn't improve, didn't hit certain benchmarks. And so they gave that up in exchange for the $400,000. It doesn't sound like a very good deal. And, you know, also, I just don't see how the dire concerns that the mayor raised, which I think were legitimate initially, you know, for traffic and disruption and the problems that the casino would bring to the city, just sort of vanished overnight.
Well, they talked about Sullivan Square infrastructure improvements, other traffic mitigation measures. Do you think that those could have been better had this agreement not been reached? Maybe could have pushed for more?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I do think that both sides needed to move on. You know, in general, I don't think it's a very good bet for Boston overall, you know, the casino bet. You look to the cautionary tales of the Plainville Casino, you know, where revenues are not meeting expectations, or, you know, if you want to say that that's just a slots parlor, this was going to be so much more beautiful, just take a look at Atlantic City, you know, where even Donald Trump might agree, you know, that the losses have been huge. You know, so I just think that it's just not a good bet for the city or the state.
Right. Arlene, what are your thoughts?
Well, you know, it's very legitimate for the mayor to have been concerned about Charlestown and the traffic nightmares they're going to have to live through in Sullivan Square. But some people are saying the mayor got some bad legal advice. You know, after all, the mayor is not a lawyer. He depends on others for legal advice, and he may not have been well served in this regard. Having said that, though, a big piece of the problem is with the law itself. It doesn't allow for neighboring communities communities next to casinos to have any reasonable say in the licensing process. And so there's a part of this whole drama that makes me feel like there's something egregiously unfair. This is a state-imposed decision. They decided where it was going to be placed by a state-passed law. So it's a state-created problem. And therefore, as far as I'm concerned, the state should solve it. If there's traffic problems because of the casino in Sullivan Square, and of course there will be, the state really has an obligation to take care of it for the city of Boston. Boston shouldn't have to do it.
Hmm. What do you think it was that finally got Walsh out of this fight, Arlene?
I think that he realized that he had no choice. You know, I agree with Renee. The deal is not a particularly good one. You know, yeah, it'll be great if they close the sludge facility and that'll cut down on truck traffic, but it's not a lot of extra money. But I have a feeling he didn't have a lot of leverage, that this was probably about as good as he could get.
Let's move on to another Boston issue in the news this week, and that was Boston Latin School and allegations of racism. We have two African-American students who attend a Boston School Committee meeting this week, and they said that school administrators at Boston Latin have not acted on their complaints that there's a racially hostile environment there. And the students said that the environment grew increasingly hostile after the protests in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014. Let's listen to this.
Then the conversation quickly turned to hate speech and became full of racial slurs as some students began to post negative pictures calling their fellow students and telling them to go back to Africa if they don't like it here.
Now we had Boston Mayor Marty Walsh on the show on Tuesday, and we asked him about this controversy at Boston Latin. And he commended the students for coming forward, and he said addressing racism in Boston requires confronting the city's history. This is what the mayor had to say.
I think that this goes deeper than what we're experiencing in Boston Latin. And I think some of the conversations that we have around race, we're going to be having around race this spring and summer, is really going to talk about what happened in the past and deal with the past. And I don't think Boston has truly ever dealt with the past around race. And I think that we've tried to push it aside, but sometimes we try to ignore it. And I think that this is really kind of putting it to the forefront that this conversation needs to happen, and not just happen in communities. This conversation has to happen in schools as well.
So, Renee Loth, in terms of this controversy at Boston Latin School and Mayor Walsh's comments about what's going on there, what do you think? Is there a historical issue going on here that prevents Boston from moving beyond it, or is there a stereotype here that we're still falling
prey to? Well, there's clearly a stereotype. Still here. I think the city of Boston doesn't look anything like it did in the 70s during busing in 1974, but those memories are searing. I mean, it's a little bit like the reputation of Boston as a town full of Irish mobsters, which, you know, keeps getting, reinforced by the sort of popular culture. I think that it's really difficult to escape, you know, that reputation, although I think the city has made terrific strides in that regard. You know, and about Latin, it's hard to know without knowing the particulars of the specifics of the complaints how bad the situation is at Latin. But, you know, if the students feel unsafe or if they feel that they're being discriminated against, you know, that has to be respected. And I think the city and the school administration are doing so. I mean, I think there's been a lot of, outreach to the students, and we'll probably see more of that.
Hmm. Eileen, how much of an issue do you think this is for Mayor Walsh, and are you surprised by what's come forward so far?
No, I'm not actually surprised at all. You know, racism comes in all shapes and sizes. You know, sometimes it's blatant and obvious and unabashed, and other times it's more subtle, more nuanced, more coded, if you will. But in either form, it's painful. And it's unacceptable. So racism in the Boston public schools in 2016, on the one hand, it's terrible. But on the other hand, to me, it's not shocking at all, especially after the tumult in Ferguson, you know, which showed how rampant the problems are and forced a lot of white folks to recognize it in ways that they hadn't seen it before. But having said all that, racial slurs in the hallways of schools, kids being told, go back to Africa. Everybody knows that's not okay. I mean, that's clear cut. There's no nuance there. And so I'm really glad that these students are raising the issue and forcing the adults to deal with it.
Do you think it was the first time we sort of saw Superintendent Tommy Chang have to address something that was getting a lot of attention? And any thoughts on how he did in this regard?
Well, I think he's brand new, right? So, yeah, right. I think it's the first time certainly something like this has come up in his watch. And I think he was really responsive and immediately set up consciousness raising is kind of a 60s term, but that kind of training for the staff and faculty there. And I think that's, an important first step. It's not the only step, certainly.
Okay, I want to move on to the budget. Governor Baker unveiled a $36.9 billion budget proposal this week that he says reflects his rather conservative fiscal views. But some, like Noah Berger, who's with the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center, say that that approach on the part of the governor has some shortcomings. Here he is on our show after the governor's budget was announced.
I think a challenge is that there's limits to how much you can get done improving efficiency, that there are some big items in the state budget that cost money, things like, you know, educating kids or providing health care are expensive. So I think ultimately there may need to be a combination of improving efficiencies and then finding ways to make investments that will make higher education affordable or expand access to early education or do all of those kinds of things that could actually make life better for people in the Commonwealth.
Arlene Isaacson, Governor Baker's budget. How do you think he did overall? There's a slight increase there, but definite differences, obviously, in terms of percentages of funds appropriated for different things that are projects of the governor. Your first thoughts on that?
Well, you know, it's true that the budget shows his fiscal conservative take on the world. It was unfortunate in many people's eyes that he expanded a corporate tax break. It may only have been $67 million, but that I think that money could better have gone to education or transportation. And on an interesting issue, someone pointed out to me that the state continues to hide, so to speak, how much money goes to charter schools. There's actually no line item in the budget that says X dollars goes for Y number of students. There's a line item that says what the reimbursement is. So last night someone said, well, you know, Arlene, 10% of Chapter 70 money, that's education aid, goes to charters, but it's not for 10% of the students. It's for like half of that. And doesn't the public have the right to know how much money, especially if we're about to engage in a debate that's important to the governor over expanding charter schools?
Right.
So I said, it's an interesting point. You know, that information is valuable to inform the debate.
Renee, your thoughts about the governor's budget?
You know, I think there were increases in his priority areas, which say a lot about him. You know, there's more money for gateway cities, for the opioid epidemic, for the Department of Children and Families. I mean, these are all areas where there's a, you know, something you might call a crisis. So he has addressed that. But I think it's also rather a modest increase. You know, I was reading that this increase in the spending for public health around opioid addiction is enough to fund 150 new treatment beds. You know, that sounds like a lot, except that there was something like, you know, 1,200 deaths to opiate abuse and overdoses in 2014, and the rate is increasing. So, you know, until he's willing to square the circle of not being in favor of any new revenue increases, any new tax increases or adjustments to the tax rates, and, you know, continues to be this no new tax governor, it's going to be increasingly hard for him to fund the priorities that he has, not to mention the priorities that others might have.
Right. His substance use proposals totaled, I think, represent a 22% increase in spending. That's the biggest increase over the last fiscal year than any other area of the budget. So on the one hand, it may only be 150 beds, but I think substance use services total gets a 22% increase. But on the other hand, the trial court's got 1%, and part of the way that the governor said he wants to deal with substance use is by making sure that there are drug courts. And the trial courts are saying, how are we going to do more drug courts with a 1% increase? So there are some inconsistencies there that I think are really interesting. And I'm wondering, Arlene, do you think that that's going to be the fight that plays out, whether it's charter schools and how do we afford them and how do we make sure that they're transparent, whether it's, you know, how are we going to fund substance use on in substance use services on a broad level, and how are we going to do this, as you point out, Renee, with no taxes or fees?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, we have a structural deficit, and because taxes continue to go down because of the ballot question that passed many years ago, with each passing year, that problem only gets worse. And unless you're willing to raise the appropriate revenue, you're going to underfund, you're forced to underfund programs. And this year, education was underfunded, transportation underfunded. You know, there may be a 1% increase in some of these line items, but inflation is not 1%. And it costs for health insurance is not 1%. Conversely, he did a selective tax, if you will, on public employees. They will be taxed more for their health insurance. No one else will. So corporations will get a tax break, and working class people will get a tax raise if they work for the state.
What about the T? Was that surprising? I mean, MBTA funding is essentially holding steady, and obviously that was the huge problem starting last January. Your thoughts on that, Renee?
Yeah, you know, he continues to say that this is not a revenue problem, it's a spending problem. And, you know, this describes his feeling about the entire state budget, but particularly around the T. He has this fiscal control board, which is trying to wrestle with some of the, you know, excesses in that he sees. But, you know, that's not enough. And you know, fairgoers, you know, people who actually ride the T, who many of whom depend on it to get to work, are going to be bearing the burden of closing the budget deficits there. And it just, you know, it just doesn't seem fair to me.
Mm. I mean, I give him credit for one thing, though. I think it's worth noting is that he did increase money for children and families, like $30 million, so they can hire more social workers to deal with some of the problems, the scandals that have happened recently. And I give him credit for that. It's just that on the other, the rest of it, if we don't raise more revenue, we're not going to be able to fund programs adequately.
Hmm. Okay, let's move on to what a big topic in the news this week, and that was the death of longtime former Providence Mayor Buddy Cianci. He died yesterday. He was 74 years old. He leaves behind a really complicated legacy, to say the least, in Providence. He completely revitalized the city on the one hand, but then he was convicted of assault charges, and then he spent 5 years in prison after he was convicted on corruption charges. So first, I'm just wondering, Arlene, let's start with you. How do you think that Buddy Cianci is going to be remembered by people? Is it going to be this mixed sort of legacy?
It's definitely mixed, but interestingly, the LGBT community had a love affair with Buddy Cianci. Huh? They absolutely adored him. In the 90s, he was supportive of domestic partner benefits long before marriage came up as it was a possibility. He would march in the gay pride parade when most mayors never would even consider doing it. And he wasn't just tolerant towards us. He was genuinely warm and appreciating, not just with mainstream LGBTs who can pass, but he'd go into gay clubs, he'd hang out with drag queens. He just had And he had this fantastic sense of humor about it that made him totally lovable, but then there was the other side.
Hmm. Right. But you think that could be overlooked by a lot of people?
Well, he was endorsed and revered for a very long time by folks in the gay community, and they're mourning him. But yeah, he had a Jekyll and Hyde side to him that had some really bad stuff on the other side of it.
Renee.
Well, I'm not sure I could top that, but I think there's a kind of perverse pride in Rhode Ireland toward him. I mean, there were a lot of voters who just loved him, and they just loved that they had this roguish, you know, character who was just, you know, catnip to the media and so on. And they just, you know, loved having him as their standard bearer. But, you know, I find it hard to see very much romantic in, you know, assault against, you know, his domestic partners or the racketeering that he was convicted of, you know, eventually served time. He did help revitalize the downtown of Providence quite a bit, but, you know, cities were coming back all over the country anyway during that period. And it's just, you know, he knew whose hand to hold and whose arm to twist, as they used to say about certain politicians in Boston. But I just don't see it as that romantic a legacy.
Well, I want to play a little bit of tape from him. This was when he announced his final bid for mayor. This was in 2014. This was after he got out of prison, after he was convicted of a second felony. He spent 5 years in prison for corruption charges and then decided he was going to run again. This was even though he was sick, knew he had cancer at this point, and he did get 45% of the vote, we should say. He didn't win, but he got 45% of the vote. But anyway, here he is when he announced his final bid in 2014.
And I love being mayor, and I think that we had a real role going on in the city, and we had a lot going on. And I think since that time, we've experienced $110 million deficits, potholes in streets. I would be absolutely flabbergasted if I were mayor and the streets were like this.
Okay, that's Buddy Cianci announcing his final bid for mayor in 2014. Of course, he didn't win, but had the city gone downhill during the 5 years that he was incarcerated before he announced again? And I also wonder, that focus on potholes and that passion for Providence, is there a comparison to be made between Buddy Cianci's way of running Providence and Tom Menino's way of running Boston, focusing on the little stuff that people pay attention to? Corruption charges, felonies aside, I'm talking about running a city and public persona in a way. Is there a comparison here or no? Arlene?
Well, I think the comparison I would make is in the personality of how they interacted with their constituents. Like Menino, Buddy Cianci was everywhere, talking to people in every venue from as I said earlier, the drag queens in a gay club to the little old ladies in a senior citizen's home within an hour of each other. And so people had a personal bond to him that was significant. But he always had this sense of humor. I read a quote recently where he said that when he was referring to himself as a young new mayor, and he said, "The day I took office, I knew as much about being a mayor as I did about brain surgery. If I had known then what the job actually required, I wouldn't have voted for myself."
He would have become a brain surgeon.
Right, right. Renee, your thoughts about the Meninos and
Nancy? Oh, I don't know. I think it's kind of a generational comparison that can be made. I do think that the mayors of the sort of Menino, Cianci ilk could be a kind of a dying breed. And I think that maybe some of the passion for him or the good feelings about him are also a kind of mourning the passing of that type of big city mayor, sort of urban ethnic, rust belt kind of city mayors that we haven't seen, many of in the last several years and probably won't anymore.
Okay, well, it's time to end our segment. We're going to end with hubbubs. Those are the short stories that might not have made it to the top of the news this week but did catch our attention. Arlene, I'm wondering, what's your hubbub for the week?
Well, I found an interesting piece in the Beacon Hill Times by Karen Court Taylor, who founded that paper. And she highlighted the fact that over the next several years, our country is going to be preparing to celebrate the 250th anniversary of various historic events that led up to the American Revolution, and that Boston has not yet engaged or stepped up to the plate to prepare for. You know, you've got the Boston Massacre in 220, you've got then the Tea Party celebration. And while there's a small group called Revolution 250 that's starting to work on it, it's really time, she thought, and I agree, for the city and the state to begin to help by lining up corporations to sponsor events and celebrations that are going to bring in millions of people to this state. If we could do it for the Olympics, we can do it to celebrate the founding of our nation and the important role Boston played in that.
Hmm. Okay. Renee, your hubbub for the week.
Well, the city of Boston, speaking of which, has received a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts to embed artists of all sorts, dancers, actors, musicians, to embed them inside city government departments in order to encourage new ways of thinking about city services. So last week, the city auditioned 11 finalists, and they will be choosing 3 artists to help, the police department or maybe public works or parks and rec be more creative about how to solve problems. I think it's easy to mock this, to think about, police department, policemen taking movement dance classes or something. But government bureaucracies do tend to get into ruts. And this is one way, I think, the cost-free way to break out of that.
Hmm. Well, I would just like to end mine and give you my hubbub. Becca Peasy of Belmont, Mass. If you don't know that name, you're probably going to hear about it today. She became the first American woman to run 7 marathons in 7 days on 7 continents.
Wow.
And she is from Belmont. People will be celebrating.
Wow.
There's already celebrations being scheduled this weekend and next week for Becca Peasy, who became the first American woman to do that.
Go,
so,
Becca.
Right. Congratulations. So anyway, we're going to say goodbye for the week. Arlene Isaacson, co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Also, Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe and regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti page. Thanks to you as well.
Pleasure.
Stay with us. Coming up, a conversation with former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.